Sin acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the land on which the Sin office and studios stand, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Sin also acknowledges and pays respect to the traditional owners of the lands our content reaches, as well as the radio stations we broadcast from across the country.
Welcome to Film 101, the show that looks at everything film, from the biggest new releases to awards hype to interviews with practitioners working on films, right through to our film recommendations. We have reached our season finale in what has been a stellar season for Film 101. We have discussed some fantastic films, albeit we could only fit so many in our show, so some films haven't made the cut, but I think we're happy with the films that we've discussed overall. Would that be fair, Tom and Darcy?
I would say so, yeah, honey, yes.
For the most part.
There was some in there that we obviously are a bit sceptical on.
Which we outright hated.
And we can mention those in our final segment today, which will kind of recap basically our most memorable parts of the season, possibly of earlier episodes as well in the year, our podcast, and we'll be recapping our top 10 favourite films pretty much of this year so far, though we've got 2 weeks left of December. So
there's some placeholders, yeah.
There's some reserved spots. I know Darcy's got a couple in there as well, but we're still not getting some of those films till January, so
February even.
Even February, that's right. So to start us off today, we do have 2 films as well that we're going to be discussing that we've seen ahead of time here and that aren't releasing, I believe, theatrically in the next couple of weeks
So the first one we're going to look at comes out Boxing Day. It's coming out in the US this week, and the second film doesn't come out here until New Year's Day.
That's correct, yeah. So with that first film, it's pretty much Jumanji The Next Level. The follow-up to the, I guess, commercially successful film of the same name, though Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle, I believe it was called, which was a reboot of the original Jumanji, the one with Robin Williams, I believe.
Are they calling it a reboot, or are they calling it like a trilogy?
They consider,
or like a quadrilogy now?
They consider these Jumanji movies to be sequels to the original one, because I think in this one they do have a character from the original film who makes an appearance, if I remember correctly.
I believe you are correct, but at this rate, I think they could keep making like 10 or 20 of them, because in this film, we've got basically most of the same cast return, with Karen Gillan as Martha, Dwayne Johnson as Eddie, Jack Black as Bethany or Fridge, Kevin Hart as Mouse Finbar or Fridge, Awkwafina as Ming, Danny DeVito as Eddie, Nick Jonas as Alex, Madison Iseman as young Bethany, Colin Hanks is in there as well as young Alex, Alex Wolff as young Spencer, and Rory McCann as Jürgen the Brutal. Now, basically, saying some of those names and who they act as, there's a bit of it can be confusing at times. Basically, how they've made this world operate, where they so you've got Danny DeVito and Donald Glover in there, who basically get sucked in to the Jumanji game, but they're they get sucked in as Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart. Whereas in the prior film, it was a couple of the younger actors in there who got sucked in as those characters, and that's pretty much what the whole film rides on, really.
It kind of feels like an SNL sketch, where it's like, this is the premise, and then they're just hoping it can ride for 2 hours, which, like, more or less it does.
Yeah. But, at the same time, it kind of falls in and out of those characters, so it does bring the younger cast, the younger actors kind of back in, as though, you know, they give Kevin Hart... Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson are basically playing different people.
And
Awkwafina's playing a different person, and there's a horse in there with wings, and it's like...
Spoilers?
Not a spoiler. It's on the poster, so it's pretty ridiculous.
There's a horse on the poster, but we don't see the wings.
I mean, they don't really insinuate anything else, Tom. if you've seen Harry Potter, you probably know what I'm referring to.
Oh, come on.
No, but what I'm saying is they can make another 10 or 20 films like this just by having older actors get sucked into Jumanji and have Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart impersonate them.
That's exactly right.
I don't think they did very well at impersonating Danny DeVito and Danny Glover.
I'd like to counteract that. I think Kevin Hart did a fabulous...
Yeah, but I much preferred when Kevin Hart was being himself for like the second half of the movie.
Well, I prefer that as well, because you can't really tone down Kevin Hart, can you?
No.
He's someone that you need. It felt weird.
I wasn't really buying into it. Yeah, you just watch. It's like you're watching two old men, and that's pretty much what it is. Two old men in younger sort of bodies. Mm. Albeit Dwayne Johnson's a much larger physique. Mm. I think he's much bigger now than he ever was. I think because he's buffing up for that new Black, what's called Black Adam?
Black Adam, yes.
Yeah, so he's much larger as well. But in terms of the plot, so in Jumanji the Next Level, the gang is back, but the game has changed. As they return to rescue one of their own, the players will have to brave parts unknown, from arid deserts to snowy mountains, to escape the world's most dangerous game. There's a lot of different setting changes in this film. And at times I even zoned out because the whole snowy things. I can't remember what happened there. I know there was the hound and like things happened to him, but like
they changed clothes, they switched bodies. I mean, a lot happened in the snow.
It's a complete blur though, Tom. I can't remember what happened. It starts off again. Starting off with kind of the younger actors before they kind of go into that world, then it heads into the kind of more, I guess, foresty setting, then the desert setting, then the snowy setting. So, yeah, it deals with, like, vast different places.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you guys found any confusion with that, or were you able to kind of track it kind of steadily as it went?
I had no problem tracking it at all. I don't know what was wrong with you on Saturday. But
maybe you're just zoning out because of the film generally.
Maybe I was just thinking about Little Women too much.
Because like it plays with, like it uses the fact that it's in like a video game universe so that it can explore all these different places.
Yeah, because that's what happens in these video games. It's that you have these entire worlds all condensed into this one tiny map.
Yeah. What I disliked about it though is that they never really went past the Google image search of like each of these settings. Like literally when they went to the desert, they started playing the Lawrence of Arabia music and I actually started laughing. Like that's just like the most cliched thing you could possibly choose to do when you show a shot of the desert.
I was expecting them to play Let It Go in the winter scenes.
That
could work. I could see that happening. But a lot of it's, or even Into the Unknown, but they're kind of going into the unknown. A lot of it is cliche in this film, and a lot of it is even just kind of satirical. You know, it's poking fun at a fair bit of different things, as that Danny Glover, DeVito.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It's allowed to do that.
But that's what it kind of rides on. And like you mentioned, Tom, this is more like a popcorn sort of film, and I think that's where that aspect of it comes through, the fact that it doesn't take itself seriously. It is very much honed in on, you know, that sort of game environment and having fun with it, which is the whole point of games. You want to have fun with it.
Well, it's the whole point of movies too. I mean, most people go to have fun.
To have a different sort of experience, like a visceral experience or maybe a life-changing spiritual experience, which I've had with one film earlier this year that we'll mention later. Mm. Yeah. But yeah, everyone goes to see films for different reasons, and I think this one's much more, that sort of popcorn
I feel like this is a movie that didn't take itself seriously but wasn't funny enough to kind of ride on that as like its sole thing.
No, yeah. I agree.
Like the only real humor I got from the movie is when Awkwafina showed up, which like made the movie so much better. And she only showed up about halfway through and just took away the entire thing.
I am amazed that they didn't put her name on the poster or even her on the poster.
She is the only thing keeping up the second half of the movie. When she starts doing a Danny DeVito impression, that should have been the whole film.
Ha! Jumanji! Ha!
Well, she just goes full Queens and it's incredible.
Jack Black's in there as well and he's quite comedic. I noticed a lot of people laughing when he's on the screen.
Jack Black.
And apparently this might be his last acting performance. Mm. He's mentioned that.
Well, I know his band's like globally touring, I think, in the next 18 months or something.
We're talking about Tenacious D.
If you follow Jablinski Games, you'll see he's literally live streams like everything.
He's on YouTube as well, yeah.
Well, not live stream, he records it, but he goes like backstage and everything. And but yeah, here, like, I think you can only take or keep the funny going for so long with the impressions. Like, they kind of wear themselves out the longer they go. Mm. You're like, okay, like I get it. You're impersonating Donald Glover, you're impersonating Danny DeVito. Like, do you know what I mean? You start to, but when you mix it up, when they started adding, like you say, Awkwafina, that freshness, like, how's she going to impersonate Danny DeVito? That was kind of intriguing compared to what was happening kind of before. So the film's got 68% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7 on IMDb, and 58% on Metacritic. So it's doing quite... Yeah, it's in the plus.
It's okay. It's not doing as well as the first movie was, that's for sure. Critically. I think someone said in the notes here that it was better than the first movie. Who was it?
I think I did, yeah.
Yeah, Arnie was.
But just by a tinge. I think I enjoyed it a little bit more. The first one, I just didn't really know what to expect when I was watching it. And then when I did see it, I was like... Yeah, I could have settled for not having that film. And then once I knew that they were going to start making more of these, then I'm like, okay, I'll relax a bit more with these films. Mm. In terms of awards for this film. So it's been nominated for the Golden Trailer Award for Best Fantasy Adventure TV Spot.
That is, it's that's the big one.
That's the one everyone that, wants to like, win.
That's this is a cinema equivalent of a participation trophy.
I appreciate that trailer awards do exist, though, because there are movies where the trailer is the best kind of part, and they're like the culmination of 3 minutes instead
of
2 hours.
Yeah, I've seen some phenomenal trailers in the not only the time we've been doing Film 101, but over the years. I mean, the Mad Max Fury Road trailer, for one, all of them, actually, they're an art form in and of themselves.
Mm. And they rely, like, a lot of, you have to make them entertaining at this point, like the trailers. But, you know, once you're showing five or six of them, do you know what I mean? Like, you run that risk of either you can't really oversell a film, but of kind of not keeping audiences as engaged.
As spoiling it. I read somewhere that when they were releasing The Amazing Spider-Man way, way back in 2012, they put out so much advertising and so much, you know, teaser footage that they ended up spoiling 22 minutes of the total runtime of the film.
Well, see,
that's impressive.
I think we've mentioned it before on the show, but like someone like Paul Thomas Anderson, when he does his trailers, he puts everything that's not in the film in his trailers, and then do you know what I mean?
Even like Star Wars movies, it's like a actual thing now to just
they've started doing it.
Do
yes.
extra footage to throw people off.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be a good way of kind of using footage that you're not actually going to be showing in the film.
I was actually reading one of the main marketing companies in Hollywood. I think they're called Trailer Park Studios, which is a bit on the nose.
Brothers, yeah.
Yes, but essentially they're given a rough cut of the film. And from that rough cut, they have to put together advertising footage. So sometimes the footage we see in trailers is from like 2.5-3 hour cuts of a movie that haven't been condensed down yet.
They also edited the Suicide Squad movie, which...
They edited the movie.
Yeah, because everyone liked the trailer so much, they were brought on after someone else edited it. And like that's kind of why the movie feels like a 90-minute trailer.
And just a couple of fun facts before we head to one of the songs.
I'm sorry, but that's just broken me, that fact.
Just a couple of fun facts before we head into the soundtrack, one of the songs from the film. Mm. So this film saw one of the fastest turnarounds from filming to theatrical release for a major studio tentpole film. Filming did not begin until February 2019 and wrapped 4 months later in May for a December release only 7 months later.
That's pretty ridiculous for the amount of CGI that's in this movie.
That is brutal. I mean, we've heard stories in the past of particularly TV actors having to work to 12, 18-hour days and feeling absolutely exhausted by the end of it. I mean, imagine doing that for a movie. I mean, you'd just be broken by the end of it.
And Jack Black referred to this movie as Jumanji 4, citing Jumanji, Zathura, Space Adventure, and Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle as the other films in the series. I wouldn't count Zathura in there. I mean, it's got similar sort of themes. It is a film about a game.
Are they made by the same studio, though, and the same production team?
Well, all the films?
I know that Jumanji and the other two Jumanjis, they're all Columbia movies. Zathura, I don't know who does that one.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I have no idea what that is.
Okay, so you've never heard of Zathura?
No.
It appears on TV all the time.
Dusty doesn't watch TV.
Oh, am I the only person here who does?
Possibly, Tom.
Yeah, okay.
You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We're going to head into our second segment of the day, looking at Greta Gerwig's latest feature, Little Woman. Now, we saw this at the Capitol last week.
Yes, Thursday.
Thursday of last week. Quite an enjoyable screening, I must say. It wasn't a full house from what I understand or from what
I saw.
No,
it wasn't. I mean, can I just tell everyone a little anecdote?
Tom.
So the three of us and another mate of ours, Jack Misson, we all went and got dinner at a pub nearby before the movie screening last week, and Arnie was really fretting because, like, we're going to be late. And then we got there with 10 minutes to spare, and, like, about the last half dozen back row seats were still empty. I mean, I was expecting this movie to sell out like you were and like Darcy was, and yet almost... Why were there so many free seats, people? I mean, come
on. She's been hollering people off the street at that point.
Yes.
I think there were people, because there was an earlier screening as well. I think people went that, and then I went and saw Bombshell last week, and there were people at that screening who were saying, oh, you know, I went and saw one screening of Little Woman, and then I decided to go see the second screening of Little Woman as well. So there was people who brought... Yeah, they brought, like, their partners or whatever.
But that's worse.
Yeah, no, but maybe some people put their names down and decided not to show, and then there was people on the like a waiting list and they never got to see it. I don't know.
Okay, the reason why this makes me angry is because Little Women, and we will get into this more in depth soon, but it is one of the best movies of the year. People should not be sleeping on this.
Yeah,
this
I can movie, understand seeing it twice.
It's phenomenal.
People that wanted to bring their partners. Like they went and saw it by themselves and they're like, I've got to bring my partner. And then they brought... but basically it stars... You guys pronounce it.
Okay, I'll just do all the names. You know, okay, so we've got Saoirse Ronan playing Jo March, Emma Watson playing Meg March, Timothy Chalamet playing Laurie or Teddy, Florence Pugh playing Amy March, Eliza Scanlon playing Beth March, Meryl Streep playing Aunt March, Laura Dern playing Mary March, James Norton playing John Brooke, Bob Odenkirk playing Mr. March, Louis Garrel playing Friedrich Baer, or Louis Garrel, rather, because he's Louis, French, Louis. Tracy Letts playing Mr. Dashwood, and Chris Cooper playing Mr. Lawrence.
A great ensemble in there, Tom. And
it's a fabulous cast.
I know that you were saying as well that this is, it might win at the SAG Awards.
Yeah, so the Screen Actors Guild Awards, they're basically the actors' version of the Oscars. So it's just basically people within the acting fraternity handing out awards to their peers. And they do individual awards as well as ensemble or group awards. And I'm thinking that Little Women might win the ensemble award because this is a great cast.
And what were your guys' first impressions upon seeing it? I know that we had a brief chat after the screening, but you know, when you went home, when you thought about it a bit more...
This movie is incredible.
I'm still amazed.
Like, everything that was good about Lady Bird and what made Lady Bird a unique film was just added to a period drama and just made it so special.
Yes. That's exactly right.
She has this ability to make every character feel like they're the protagonist of their own world. And, like, everyone is the most fully realized version of themselves. Whereas so many of these movies... Like, Mr. Lawrence would have, like, two scenes, and then he'll be, like, the grumpy, surly guy, and then he'll have, like, but he has a heart of gold. And in this, he has, like, this entire arc that you just, like, fall in love with him by the end.
That's exactly right. Like, I mean, and props to Chris Cooper as well. I mean, as you say, he's only in the movie for a short amount of time, but he is just phenomenal in every scene. He's just outstanding. He made me feel for this character in less than 10 minutes of screen time.
See, I've overheard people say that one of the grievances with the film is to do with character and the fact that Greta Gerwig doesn't provide, like, establish them properly. It's kind of like almost assuming that you kind of know who these characters are and what they kind of
I feel like that comes to the fact of, like, how iconic this story is, how well-versed everyone is in this story, and that's what allows Greta Gerwig to play with it the way she does. So she uses both books and all of Louise Alcott's notes and, like, short stories, and pretty much transfuses them into each other in, like, two different timelines, which is done, I think, better than pretty much any film I've ever seen do different timelines.
No, that's done really expertly because they changed the color grading.
Yeah.
So the earlier scenes have sort of like a yellow tint to them, and the later scenes have a bluer tint. And as we progress into, like, the present day, as such, it's all like the two blend together to form this perfect
color
combination.
Yeah, and the camera work's done a lot differently in between the two. Like, I know you were saying, Arne, that there were some scenes you were, like, confused. I think towards the end, where, like, the two timelines kind of converge, basically.
Yeah, well, because it's almost a boiling point by the end. It's like it's clashing really quickly, like both timelines, until they reach one sort of point, like a climax of sorts.
And the mate of ours we were mentioning before, Jack Misson, he's also vision impaired. He's legally blind, and I was expecting him to have trouble, like, distinguishing between the two scenes. But he said, no, it was fine. Like, again, it was the yellow tinting, the blue tinting. It made it so easy for
him. Yeah, there was so much care put into making sure, like, nothing was confused. Because, like, it wasn't important, I think, that, like, you're trying to be deceived and, like, oh, where am I? Like, the same way, like, Christopher Nolan uses different timelines to confuse an audience. And Gerwig's using it to, like, emphasize themes and being able to match themes throughout time periods in someone's life more than tell a coming-of-age story, which is kind of the point of the original Little Women.
Well, none of us have actually read the novel, from what I understand, right? You guys haven't?
No.
It's not that we can't read, it's just that we choose not to.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. So what would your kind of advice be for people coming into a screening of Little Women not being familiar with the source material or films from the past, from before?
I think everyone's going to love it no matter what. Like,
no, I mean, we approached it all as somebody who'd never read the book, and we came away absolutely loving it as well.
I still knew, like, all of the beats that is in this movie. Like, I've seen the original, like, the 90s movie. I haven't seen the 1930s one with Julie Garland.
There's like
10 different TV ones. Like, yeah.
There's a lot of adaptations.
It's a universe. Like, it's one of the most important, I think, American literature stories.
I think it was really quite easy for me to kind of get caught in Greta Gerwig's world, purely because I was getting a lot of Jane Austen vibes. I mean, I can tie that sort of literature. Obviously, American and British literature is not the same thing.
No.
But, you know, films like, or rather books like Emma and Persuasion and the sorts, I was really, like, connecting the dots in terms of her work and how it might be similar to Little Women in that sense.
No, it was the same for me. When I was watching the trailer for Little Women, I was actually getting Pride and Prejudice vibes because it reinforces heavily those themes of like growing up, growing old and marriage and being single and that sort of thing.
Or just not going as well with kind of the grain of like what everyone expects of you as well.
Or that as well, yes.
At least that's what I found with these characters. And they're really likable characters as well.
Like, yes. Yeah. Like, it's the same as Lady Bird. Like, I feel like there were so many characters she has where they could just be written off as just, like, this one type of person. And that everyone has, like, a fully developed story. Like, I think this is the... from what I've read, basically, this is the first time people have liked Amy March. Like, she's always been the character that's like, oh, she's the one that... I don't want to say spoilers because the story is 150 years old.
Yeah.
But Amy March burns Joe's book. And for so much of, like, the entirety of Little Women, like, the culture of it for 150 years is that Joe March is the protagonist and everyone else is kind of working around it because she's the writer's, like... She basically... The writer is Joe March in this...
I want to point out as well, with that characterization of Amy, they don't play it as someone who's like a real spoiled brat. They play it as someone who's like young and naive.
Yeah.
And because, you know, young girls do rash and foolish things.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think she's the youngest, I'm pretty sure. She was supposed to be 13 in the first timeline and 20 in the other one.
Yeah.
And I think the 90s movie had her played by two different actresses.
Mm.
And in this one, Florence Pugh's pretty much, like, I was saying it before, she might be one of the best under 24 actors around. Like, she's incredible in this.
Wasn't Beth March younger?
Beth is the youngest.
Okay. I figured, with Beth that she was youngest. But, with Greta Gerwig, both of her films, Lady Bird and this, they're really, I've noticed, she's going to be a director who's going to be emphasizing character above everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
And letting, kind of her actors explore the world that she creates for them. Rather than, you know, having it so strict on them, do you know what I mean, to follow a kind of set protocol. There's a lot of, what I understand, freedom on her set and letting her kind of bringing these kind of actors. And when you look at the cast list here, a lot of them have a lot of range as well.
Mm.
Obviously, we've got Charlamagne on there and you mentioned Florence Pugh. So I guess, how do you guys see Greta Gerwig's career going from here in terms of the sort of films that she does make? Do you reckon they're going to stay close to kind of character-driven films or ensemble sort of films? Or how do you kind of see her going?
I mean, I love that after Lady Bird and after Frances Ha and those small movies that she was able to make a $40 million Sony movie.
Mm.
And as well, it's not directly confirmed at the moment, but she's supposed to be making a Barbie movie with Margot Robbie, which on its face sounds ridiculous, but it's also supposed to be Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach co-writing and possibly co-directing. And that just sounds like the most interesting thing in the world. Like, it could be the most ridiculous thing, but they're possibly the two greatest screenwriters of, like, this really intimate storytelling.
Well, the way I see it is that Greta Gerwig, she brings a lot of energy to her movies and a lot of resonance. So what I expect to see from her in the years to come, and I imagine should she make the Barbie movie, this will be exactly the same. We get these really profound moments that, you know, make us reevaluate our lives and rethink the way we see the world.
I do want to say as well, this movie is very 2019. Like, I feel like for such an old story set in the 1860s, it could have easily just been a Pride and Prejudice movie, but this is such an energetic, frenetic movie.
But she shows restraint as well. I mean, for one, it's still got the G rating. It's got the original family-friendly appeal of the source
material.
It's like
a Christmas movie.
It's
delightful.
Yeah, and the second point I was going to make has completely escaped me now. I'm sorry.
Well,
I'll come back to it. Don't worry.
I'll try filling the blanks, Tom. Critical scores, it's got 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7.5 on IMDb, and 91% on Metacritic so far. So, it's been praised.
And this hasn't actually been released yet, to be
properly. So a lot of this is coming from critics. But currently in the plus, by a fair bit.
Yeah.
In terms of nominations and awards, so at the Golden Globes coming next year, it's already received a couple of nominations for Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture Drama. Tom, can you please pronounce her name? I hate getting it wrong.
Okay, so which one am I reading again?
The Golden Globes.
Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse Ronan. There we are.
Yeah. Best Original Score, it's also got a nomination in Motion Picture for Alexander
Desplat.
AFI Awards in the USA. It's won an AFI Award for Movie of the Year.
That is huge.
That is pretty big. Hollywood Critics Association. It's been nominated for two HCA Awards, one for Best Costume Design for Jacqueline Duran and for Best Score, Alexander Desplat. And, I mean, we can only see it going. When we're looking at the Oscars, it's going to keep I think it's going to get a fair few nominations.
We had to talk about it in like peripheral of this being snubbed, like Greta Gerwig being snubbed at the Golden Globes, and now after seeing it seems even more
absurd.
Ridiculous that the Joker is getting more nominations than the people that made this incredible movie, right?
God, like, damn it.
And we're not here to vent the Joker, but
Can we though? Please.
I didn't say this last week, but so out of 77 years at the Golden Globes, there's been 5 female directors nominated, and that's just a ridiculous thing that exists and hasn't changed after this year.
Especially when you consider how many great female directors there are working today. Not just Greta Gerwig, but the likes
Lulu Wang,
Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
And I've just remembered the second point I wanted to make as well.
Catherine Bigelow.
Yes, not forgetting her. Darcy was mentioning before this being a 2019 movie. If this had been any other director who wanted to have a contemporary take on this story, they would have added like some nauseating pop song.
Oh, no, I mean, the other way I guess it could have worked would have been Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, actually.
Which is a very specific vibe, and I love that movie, but this one works, I think, because it still is grounded in the setting. I think because the score is so specific to this sort of movie, and the cinematography is very close to like
part of
which is very close to like The Favourite and Barry Lyndon.
Yeah,
it looks like those sort of movies.
And I do want to mention a couple of fun facts. Emma Watson actually took over the role of Meg March from Emma Stone, who became unavailable due to scheduling conflicts with promoting The Favourite. Ironically, Stone previously took over the role of Mia in La La Land after Watson dropped out of a project, due to the commitment of her role as Belle in the Disney live-action remake of Beauty and the Beast.
Wouldn't it be even more ironic if they did a movie together? Emma Stone, Emma Watson.
The two Emmas, Emma Watson, Emma Stone in Emma. Jane Austen's Emma.
Yeah. Make it happen, Hollywood.
I'm pretty sure we are getting an Emma film next year, though.
We are, actually.
It's gone kind of under the radar, though, for a lot of people. Although they portray heroines of American literature, none of the 4 leading ladies are American. Emma Watson and Florence Pugh are English.
Saoirse Ronan is Irish.
And Eliza Scanlon is actually Australian. There you go. Greta Gerwig was originally tasked by Sony Pictures to write a new screen adaptation of Louis May Alcott's novel after the studio had rejected earlier scripts by Olivia Milch and Sarah Polley. However, after the success of Gerwig's Lady Bird, Sony Pictures hastily offered Gerwig the chance to direct this film using her script in the hopes of forcing the delayed project into production after years of development hell.
I just want to correct the two of you as well. It's Louisa May Alcott. So please don't come burning down our studio if we get it wrong.
Did I say Louis?
Yeah.
This is not a literature radio show, I'm sorry.
No, that's why we studied film. How influential do you guys think Sony were on Gerwig? Do you think that they would have had a lot of, you know...
I think the important thing that you just said there is that they hastily ran to Greta Gerwig to direct the movie.
So
instead
it doesn't sound like they were overly enthusiastic.
Watching this movie, I didn't see a lot of studio interference, I'll be perfectly honest. I think that this truly is Greta Gerwig's vision that they're witnessing.
She feels like a very overwhelming kind of presence. Like, I feel like when you watch, like, Frances Ha and you see her on screen, and then her movies are pretty much a representation of that energy. On a creation, I can't see anyone influencing her decisions.
Well, I can't see anyone doing much to Little Woman, the actual brand of the novel.
Well, my initial thought watching this was because it's a contemporary release, it's made in 2019, they might be aiming for that more mature side. So I was thinking this would be rated PG or even M walking into the movie. Mm. But no, it's rated G, and I suspect that Greta Gerwig might have had something to do with that. The studio might have said, why don't you give it like a broader appeal and make it PG? And she said, no, why should I? you know, it's perfect the way it is.
Mm.
And maybe I'm just speaking too highly of her, but she's amazing.
You can't.
Oh, no, it's bound for a rewatch. That's 100%
sure. I think this might go down as like one of the best Christmas movies. Like, it's going to come out at Christmas, but like the setting during Christmas, and it just feels like a warm, nice, wintry Christmas movie. Like, I'm going to watch this every Christmas, I think.
And any final thoughts on Little Women, guys? Any sort of film recommendations? Maybe things to see before watching Little Women?
Well, definitely get on board Lady Bird.
Yeah.
Because it's got an M rating, an MA, I think, in Australia. So
I think it's R in the US,
Yeah, so it's aimed towards a more mature audience. But, yeah, again, it's emotionally resonant, it's really clever, and it made me see the world in a whole new light. So, yeah, definitely watch Lady Bird.
You're listening to the Film 101 podcast on Sin. We are going to head into our final segment of the show, of the season, for that matter, and we're basically going to recap, I guess, our favourite moments of the season, our favourite films of the year. Do you guys want me to start first? Head into it?
Yeah, well, let's do that.
You can justify it. I'm really curious to hear this.
And
I can try justify it.
Just a request as well, Arnie. Could you do it counting down, so from 10 to 1?
10 to 1, okay.
Yep.
So I went back on my Letterboxd ratings, and I've been going off of that for this list.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's still some films that I haven't seen. I'm going to try to squeeze in the next 2 weeks, so this list isn't locked in 100%. But starting at 10, I've got John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum. Now, I believe it's Chad Stahelski who directed it. I really liked this film. I know when I saw it, I thought it was like incredible. Like the action sequences and the way that it went about, because he was a stuntman, I believe, in the Matrix films prior to directing it. So he brought a lot of knowledge for the stunt work for this film. And it's such a shame as well that like the Oscars don't have categories tailored towards stunt work.
Yeah.
Because it's so profound. And I know there's a lot of voiceful people out there who think the same. Like Christopher McQuarrie, he's big on that, saying stunt work should be there. But yeah, I thought the stunts in this film were terrific. Keanu Reeves on a career high, doing incredibly well. Just on the whole, yeah, a really entertaining couple of hours at the cinema, and some really, like, some of the best sequences I've seen this year. I know that that whole sequence with the glass, and, you know, when they're chucking Keanu Reeves through the glass, that whole sequence I was just getting, like, the amount of, like, it was both Matrix vibes, and I was getting vibes of, like, a video game, because it was almost structured as a couple of levels. So there was a lot in this film that I really enjoyed. I'm not sure how you guys felt about John Wick.
Yeah, I think the cinematography of this, like, specifically this John Wick movie is really underrated. Like, I think visually this is one of the most striking movies of the year.
And a lot of people, I think you even said yourself, Arnie, that it's better than the first two.
Yeah, I did. I liked it much more than the first two. Because I think that people actually started kind of separating it from the fact that, you know, the first one is, oh, a dude hates his dog gets killed, he goes after people. I think people started realizing there's more to this film and this franchise than just that.
Yeah.
So this one was a much more mature one and complete one.
Yeah, I think the first film rided a lot on the fact that Keanu Reeves was in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that was its selling point.
Well, it was I guess a shock for some people as well, seeing, oh, Keanu Reeves is back, or surprise rather.
Yeah.
Oh, he's back on center stage doing a big film that not a lot of people had heard about.
Mm.
So yeah, with this one, that's sitting on my list at number 10. At number 9, I have Us, the Jordan Peele film, following obviously Get Out. I had a fun time with this one. I remember seeing this with Scott, who's been on the show a couple of times. I think we both really enjoyed it. It was like we sat there once the credits came on and we're just like what just happened, like, because that whole last sequence, it's like I was watching M. Night Shyamalan film, do you know what I mean, in terms of like twists and that sort of thing, and I was like, oh, it's Jordan Peele. And then I just really enjoyed this film. I think it's a mature and again sturdy sort of follow-up to Get Out, and it'll be interesting to see where he goes from here. At number 8, I've got I Lost My Body, the film that we discussed, I believe it was last week on the show.
Yes, just last week.
Yep, I found this to be one of the most complete animations of the year. It was tough between this and Toy Story 4. Toy Story 4 has just missed out on my top 10. But yeah, I Lost My Body was just a different sort of animation for me. And we've seen some really interesting and groundbreaking animations in the last year and a half too. I count that as one of them, and that's why it's made number 8 on my list. Mm-hmm. Number 7, I've got The Souvenir. Directed by
Joanna Hogg.
Joanna Hogg, that's the one. Yeah, it slipped my mind. I'm trying to remember all these names. The Souvenir, I guess, initially seeing it, it was quite a slow film. I must say, there was a lot of people that walked out, but that's when I knew that I was watching something special. A lot of businessmen that walked out. I know you're on the screen as well. So I was just like, yep, I know I'm watching a good film now. No, but upon rewatch,
that should be the criterion for which all films are judged. How many businessmen walk out of the theater?
I kid you not. Once I see, you know, I count by number. If I see more than 10 walk out, you know it's a great film. But here, again.
Yeah. No, I agree. This is my number 6 on my list. Like, this is a really interesting, I think a very unique sort of film. Like, the way it's paced, it definitely takes a while to kind of acclimatize to it. I think seeing it outside of a cinema was actually more rewarding.
And we were mentioning this after the screening. It feels like a much more personal film. It deals with really heavy themes as well. So watching it in a crowded audience environment with just, you know, the odd laugh here and there where people were kind of uncertain.
I think it's because it was an audience that was kind of out on the movie about 10 minutes in. And it's a really hard movie to kind of like focus on.
People that were coming in expecting one thing and then, you know, because some people try to force their laughs with certain films because they don't know how to react in certain moments. Mm. Sits at number 7 for me. Number 6, Little Woman has climbed into the race. It's in the top 10. I think we've all got it somewhere in there. But we will mention Tom's and Darcy's in a bit. Yeah, Little Woman, it's made the cut. I think it was an incredible film, a great achievement by Greta Gerwig. Again, great ensemble. I can see it winning a couple more awards heading into the awards season.
So, I think it's going to do well commercially as well.
I think it's going to have a great shelf
definitely.
Life.
Yeah. Because Lady Bird actually did quite well commercially too.
Yeah, Lady Bird's one of A24's most successful movies.
I think it's their most successful, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this was going to hold up as well, really good on rewatch. I think it's going to have a decent shelf life as well. Midsommar is at number 5. Ari Aster, I've been, you know, after watching Hereditary, I think with him and someone like Robert Eggers, A24 have two, they have multiple great actors, but I think with them two, they have...
You mean directors.
Directors, that's right, sorry. They have two terrific directors going in and they're going to get some great content out of them. And with Midsommar, I thought it was just so different to what I expected. Watching it, I'm just like, I was blown away. And they've mentioned as well, they've cited Bergman as a heavy influence on them. I think that you can see a lot of that coming through.
Yeah, and Florence Pugh is incredible in this. Especially, you just have a back-to-back in two movies.
I know, that just caps
how good of a 2019 she's having.
And she was terrific in both films. In Little Woman, arguably the best performance in there. And then at 4, I've got The Irishman, Scorsese. I mean, you know, there's people that just love Scorsese, like mega fans of him. I appreciate the guy. I understand he's a cinema tyrant, and it's not for that reason that I've put The Irishman 4th, but The Irishman, I rewatched it, so 7 hours of Scorsese in the space of a week. Upon rewatch, I picked out so many more different things and so many more subtleties that just cap off what sort of director Scorsese is. So down to the last minutia, like he's crazy in terms of like details and the small little kind of things that influence everything that happens to characters later in his films. So that one has made number 4 on there, and it's also going to win a fair bit of awards. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood comes in at 3rd. Again, it was tough between this and The Irishman. Looking at it, I know we saw this at Darcy at the Australian premiere, and I was blown away by how much I enjoyed. How much I enjoyed most of the sequences, how different to Tarantino's other work it was, a much more non-Tarantino sort of film, accompanied by great performances in there, and I guess it's a hangout film similar to Dazed and Confused for those that have seen it, much the same sort of vibe. So I think if you've seen Dazed and Confused, you'll really enjoy this. If you like Dazed and Confused, you'll enjoy this. Number 2, I've got Marriage Story, a film that Tom didn't like.
Rub it in, why don't you?
I have to. Tom seeing us.
It's hard when we both love it so much.
And it's really up there on the list. Marriage Story was just a different sort of experience for me. I mean, I'm not married. I'm not divorced. So I can't relate maybe to that struggle, but I can relate to the sort of, I guess, the feelings of love that these characters bring to the table and the sort of emotions they evoke and just how much it, Burbank kind of twists divorce and marriage on its head through Driver and Johansson, which I'm not sure whether Tom agrees, or he might agree later on.
I think, and I was discussing this after Little Women, the problem I had with Marriage Story is because I've never been in a relationship, I've never been married, I've never fallen out of a relationship, I can't relate to anything that's going on. And more importantly, these two characters, one's like an established New York theatre director, the other's an established actress, I can't relate to these people. I mean, they're successful. I'm not successful. How am I supposed to relate to that?
Look, Tom, I mean, that's the thing. Everyone's going to find something different in these sort of films, and we know that going into and watching certain films. And I think that's why I really enjoyed it. And I'm a huge fan of Adam Driver as well, as we all are on the show, and Scarlett Johansson.
Okay, I promise I won't say anything more about Marriage Story. Okay, I'll just let you have your fun.
And topping my list, and this was, you know, a tough call between the two, but I put...
I need to know why Beach Bum is number one on your list.
Beach Bum is number one on my list because, I've rewatched it a couple of times, about three times, I think. It's the most spiritual experience I've had with a film. I think I just did not expect to feel the way I felt upon watching it. I don't think I was expecting to give a Harmony Korine film 5 stars.
So had you seen his other movies?
I've seen Spring Breakers. I haven't seen Kids. But yeah, watching that, and the dude was like a nutcase years ago. So watching this, I feel like it's a huge step away from what he's done before, yet it's so similar to what he's done before, going off of Spring Breakers. I think there's a fair bit of complete... pretty much all the performances in there are really complete, and it's kind of a film that's separated into just different sort of phases. It's almost like, it's a character going through and interacting with these different sort of quirky and interesting characters and just having a different sort of unique experience with each one of them. And I guess that's the whole point, seeing this character and how he changes but doesn't change throughout the whole film, yet there's just a sincerity in seeing, you know, Matthew McConaughey go through Corian's world in a role that he was pretty much born to play. And that's why it's kind of topped my list. And I can go on for another hour discussing this, but I just don't have the time. So let's head into what Tom's top 10 films of the year were.
Okay, so at my number 10, I had Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We discussed it at length on the show before. We all love the movie. I think that the reason I put it at number 10, though, rather than like top 3, top 5, is because it didn't become a great movie for me until like the last half hour or so. I mean, that's when it really hit home for me, and that's when we saw that Tarantino magic. For the rest of the movie, it's just like, it's fun, but it's meandering in a kind of way. Number 9, I've got an Australian picture, Judy and Punch, directed by Mira Forks. This came out at the tail end of the year, and I put this one here because it surprised me. For one, it was quite energetic, it was quite fast, it was quite fun, and it was a really interesting spin on the traditional female revenge tale, I thought. This was the movie that The Nightingale should have been to me, because it showed restraint. It knew when to turn the camera away, when to point the camera towards something. Yeah, it knew what audiences wanted to see, what they needed to see, and what they didn't need to see, essentially.
I haven't seen Judy and Punch yet, but Tom's really selling it well on here.
No, thank you very much. I'll take that compliment. I put Us at number 7, so just above where Arnie had
it. You missed one, Tom.
Oh, sorry. Number 8, how could I forget this? It's Long Shots, which was the movie starring Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. It feels like it was tailor-made for me, really. I mean, it's got this out-of-work, overweight, unshaven writer just, you know, winning the affections of some attractive presidential candidate. So, yeah, I think the ending, it's a bit too fairy-tale-esque, but the rest of the movie, I found it really funny, quite resonant, and quite smart and complex as well, which we don't see enough of in romantic comedies.
I actually got a like on one of my tweets tweeting Seth Rogen about this film.
So you did talk about this on the show.
Yes,
and number 7 is Us. It's actually quite surprising. We haven't heard a lot about it heading into awards season. I assumed this would be the kind of movie that we'd be talking about for weeks, months, years afterward, and it's sort of like slowed to a halt because of the other great movies which have come out.
I think it's won an award from the African Film Society for best film.
Yep.
I think Lupita's getting a lot of accreditation now for it, even though the movie did come out about 8 months ago.
And even though she got snubbed at the Globes.
Yeah.
Because it came out so early in the year, I think people have just, forgotten about it for some reason.
Number 6, I have placed Little Women. We've talked about that at length here. I truly do believe it's one of the best movies of the year. Just above that, number 5 is James Mangold's Ford v Ferrari. Now, my only criticism really here is, and I did mention this, if not here, on the other radio show I do, Art Smitten, here on Sin, is that it's a very white male film. I mean, in Ford v Ferrari, there are only 2 African-Americans and only one of them has a speaking role. Little Women, a story which is set during the mid-19th century, has more better African-American representation, and 2 of them have speaking roles. So Yeah, that's the kind of level we're working from here. Mm. But with that said, I'm a huge Petrolhead, and this movie just had me enthralled from beginning to end. Like, especially Christian Bale, Matt Damon, Katrina Bolf as Mrs. Christian Bale. I've forgotten her name. So Ken Miles' wife is what I'm saying. Mrs. Molly Miles. Miles. There we are. I just remembered. Number four. This might come as a surprise. It's How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. I mean, I was just blown away by this. I didn't expect that a second sequel could be this good, this profound. And, you know, it kind of leaves you wanting more, but at the same time, it's got such a perfect ending bit that you want it to end here. And that's why I placed it so highly on this list. It's because it knows when to wrap things up. It's not trying to milk more money out of a sequel. It's just saying, let's leave it here. This is the story. This has reached its end.
And it's got some of the most beautiful animations seen in an animation this year. It was ridiculous.
Tell me about
it. The colour as well. Oh, my God.
Mm. Okay, number three is a movie that we haven't discussed on this show very much. It's Parasite, directed by Bong Joon-ho, who we did talk about on the show last week during our Golden Globes discussion. And it's just such a fascinating story. It's unique. It's original. I haven't seen anything like it in years. My only trouble with the film is like the ending, it kind of just loses its way a little bit, so
it's
that's
a
why
wild
it's not hiding
ending. I mean, the whole movie is wild from start to finish, but yeah, it kind of becomes everything at once and you kind of get blown over by it.
Yeah,
it is pretty much the consensus best movie of the year as well, like by I think a collection of everyone.
Yeah, it's the film that might creep into my top 10 hopefully but in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah,
that's the one I'm really
I still can't believe you haven't seen it. I haven't
gotten around to it, Dustin.
Okay, number two on my list. I'm the only one who has this in their top 10. It's Avengers Endgame. I mean, it's really not a surprise, is it?
Well, you're doing it for the Marvel fans, Don.
No, I'm doing it for me. I really enjoyed this film. The only thing
I would have it on my extended list.
Yes, I didn't care for the fact that it was 3 hours long. In fact, I didn't notice it at all. I love the action. I love the comedy. The only problem I have with it is the way they characterized Thor. But other people say that's the most brilliant part of the movie. So, you know, what do I know?
A lot of people can cosplay as that Thor now. So
yeah, yes, they can. That's the thing. That's very true. But number one, it is a movie I've been telling people for months and months and months that they need to see. It's the Adam Goods documentary, The Australian Dream. No other movie in 2019 had a more profound effect on me.
Really. And it's more documentary, though. Isn't
it is a documentary.
Yeah. I love that you have a documentary first.
It's a feature-length documentary, but it does tell a really compelling narrative, and it just makes you want to be a better person. Watching this movie, it makes you angry, it makes you sad, but it ultimately brings you joy. It says there is good in the world, despite what everybody else is telling you.
And it was a really good cinema experience.
Oh, yes.
I really liked it as a communal watching movie, which I think documentary kind of has over fiction films pretty much all the time, if they're, like,
well-executed.
Well done, yeah.
Darcy, your top 10 films?
All right, I'll try and speed through this a little bit. My number 10 is the Martin Scorsese, Bob Dylan mild documentary, Rolling Thunder Review. So it's basically sort of is, sort of isn't a real movie. It's so hard to describe. So basically, like, it's about a 1970s Bob Dylan tour where they went around the world, went around America, and parts of the movie are real, parts of the movie are not real. They have Sharon Stone pretending that she went on tour with these people, even though she did not. It's incredible. Like, it's so unique.
I have to ask, you were raving about this film early on, like, so much. You were saying it might be your best film of the year. Why does it come in at 10?
Honestly, like, I saw every movie that is above that after this movie.
And you just thought,
like, no, at the time, like, this was just such a unique experience. And then just the more I read about it, the more interesting it got. I know, it just kept going. Mm. And then, like, being a massive Bob Dylan fan, it was just candy.
Adds another layer.
Yeah. Number 9 for me was The Farewell, Lulu Wang's movie. Aquafina is just incredible.
Script is great. Everything's great.
It's, like, hilarious and, like, heartbreaking. It has probably one of my favorite final shots, I think, of, like, any movie. Mm. Number 8, I have Midsommar. I think probably the best horror movie of the year. I think that's pretty easy to say. I think, like, parts of it are over-filmed, which is something Ari Aster always kind of does, but it's just so well-made and so unique in, like, the setting and everything. Number 7, I have The Irishman. It's a great movie. It's just very long. I want to tell everyone not to split it up into 40-minute segments like
yes,
some people on Twitter have been trying.
Don't do it. Don't do it. No.
Can't do that with
you
a film.
Just start the movie at like 6:30. It's fine. Yes. Like,
are we saying AM?
You have time.
No. Even better. Start it just
New
after
Year's
lunch,
Day.
And then, you know, it finishes about 4:30, and then you can go and make tea.
We have two public holidays coming up. Just
we do.
Do it. Just watch it then.
Well, more than that. We've got
More.
Christmas Day,
yeah,
Boxing
going.
Day, New Year's Day,
Watch
Australia
it with the family.
Day.
Yes. Have an existential crisis with the in-laws. Number six, I have The Souvenir. I don't think we need to speed through this. Number five, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Number four, Little Women. Number three, Marriage Story. Number two, Parasite.
Please elaborate on your number one pick.
Okay. My number one is Portrait of a Lady on Fire. This is a movie that is coming out Boxing Day. I hope everyone watches it. France apparently didn't watch it because they didn't nominate it for their Oscar foreign language film.
Oh, what do the French know, honestly?
They nominated Les Miserables. This is probably the best-looking film of the year. It has the best final shot, I think, ever. I don't know what else to say.
I agree with you.
It won the Best Screenplay Award at Cannes. It may be the greatest romance ever written. I don't think I can undersell how incredible. This is my fourth... Okay, undersell it slightly. This is my fourth favorite movie of the decade.
Ooh.
Like this... I don't know. This is like a perfect movie.
Okay, it's kind of like, for me, because I have seen a preview of it, it's kind of Call Me By Your Name crossed with Blue as the Warmest Color. Would that be a fair assertion?
Yes, but this... Yeah. And it's,
I mean, that again is underselling it and simplifying
yeah.
it, but...
What yeah. separated your top three?
From everything else?
From each other, rather. Why... Portrait.
I think how unique the. I think Parasite and Portrait are the two most unique movies I've seen in a long time. I just think Portrait is a much more emotionally affecting movie. I think like you can connect to characters more than Parasite can, but I think that's kind of just it's easier to connect to two characters than an entire ensemble. Mm. Yeah, I just want everyone to see this movie, really.
And I mean, I guess with that, we just don't have the time to get through our most memorable moments.
Should have done a top 10, but here we are.
I mean, well, you know how it is. We always go out on a limb when we're discussing some of these really
personal
topics.
And this was an amazing year of movies.
It was
so much stronger than
most
years.
It was terrific. It's really capped off the decade in a great fashion. And
on a high.
Setting off 2019 and the decade on a high. That's right, Tom. Mm. So with that, I mean, we have to wrap up. Thank you, Tom and Darcy, for being a part of the season this season. I think we've had a blast. Again, we've discussed some fantastic films, some of the best films that we've seen in a long time. Mm. Hopefully, we'll be back again soon, either in the form of a podcast or possibly another season, though that's yet to be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And where can you find us, Tom?
Okay, so you can find us over the summer on our Facebook page, which is Film101SYN. That's a little handle there. It's the same handle on Twitter, and you can also follow us or contact us via email, rather, film101syn@gmail.com. And I know we've got to wrap up, Arnie, but I just want to say thank you very much for producing this show. It has been phenomenal getting to know you, working with you throughout 2019. Darcy, it's been
an
honour to meet you.
Yeah, definitely.
It's been
likewise.
Absolutely wonderful. And yeah, I do sincerely hope we can do this again in 2020.
I likewise say the exact same thing back to you, Tom. You've basically taken all the words out of my mouth. It's been an incredible year. And hopefully there's more of the same soon, because I know that we all are eager to discuss more. And there's so much more to discuss coming up with Globes and Oscars. And yeah, we just need to have more episodes discussing the new films coming out and the awards. So with that, you've been listening to Film 101 on Sin. I've been Arnie.
I've been Tom.
I've been Darcy.
And till next time.
Bye-bye.